So returning to open session, it's time for our review of total portfolio performance. So I want to welcome Mr. Whalen from Verisk this morning, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So as I do, I will speak to the economic landscape, the market landscape for a bit. Briefly today, which I'm sure you'll appreciate, because the economic landscape is very similar to the report that I gave the last time I was in here 3 months ago. The one difference is that the market seems to have settled on a narrative where the soft landing is probably the most probable outcome. That's the market narrative, right? So that's what people are expecting now. The economy does continue to plug along. It looks like the higher for longer rates that we've been expecting are also in play, but it hasn't slowed the economy. The GDP, fourth quarter GDP was just reported out this morning, came in at 3.2%. That followed a very strong third quarter, and first quarter of this year is anticipated to be about the same, 3.2%. So far, that's the forecast for the first quarter. So employment remains strong. Corporate earnings are coming in for the S&P 500 ahead of schedule. And despite the fact that rates are high, the economy is plugging along. An interesting characteristic of this market is that it's very narrow, right? You've probably heard of the Magnificent Seven, which Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Tesla. Those seven stocks in 2023 returned 71%. So that's those seven stocks of the S&P 500 returned 71%. The other 493 stocks returned 6%. For an overall S&P 500 return of 19%. So it's a very narrow market, and if you weren't participating in those seven stocks, you really missed out in 2023. So can I go now? It has been a really interesting market dynamic. The question is, are those stocks worth the value that people are paying up for it? And one other point about those stocks is those seven stocks make up 30% of the S&P's market capitalization. So it's just a very focused market. One of the interesting things about that group of stocks is they're being driven by this AI trend, right? People are making comparisons back to the late 1990s and the tech bubble that, as we all know, ended pretty badly. But there are differences, right? There are real productivity gains coming out of this. There are real earnings coming out of this. It's a big question as to whether the earnings that some of these seven are enjoying are going to spread more broadly to the broader economy and other companies that actually put the AI applications to work for their own benefits and for their own productivity and profitability. And it expands beyond these pick and shovels providers in this new trend. And time will tell. I'm actually hopeful that it won't be a big debacle like the tech bubble bursting. And that's mostly because there seems to be something real there, whereas with the tech bubble, at least the initial phase of it, companies were valued at infinity. But there's real earnings behind what we're seeing now. So with that, I'll just make a few comments and go to a few pages here, mostly in relation to as kind of a foreshadowing of your all's quarterly performance. And I'll ask you, since we don't have the screens up, I'll ask you to turn to page 46 of the board book, and it's a slide entitled U.S. Economics Summary. And as I mentioned, the fourth quarter GDP came in strong. You can see here on the table on the right, our most recent print as we went to production in this document was 2.9%.
Get some green on the page numbers to start.
Yeah, 46 is not what you're...
10. It's 10 by slide. 46 by...
Yeah. So, oh, I'm sorry. So
that is 46 because I'm taking the presentation from the electronic format, but in the hard copy.
Yeah. Okay. So
what page on the hard copy then?
10. So I'll try and be more, I'll try and give both pages. How about that? Yeah, no, I get it. I always struggle on what page to go to with here. And now I'm both electronic and hard copy. So it's, you know, my mind is kind of exploding right now. And then, if you look at the inflation numbers, so that's come down pretty significantly from, you know, we've seemed to certainly have passed peak inflation, but it's remaining stubbornly high, and that's the ongoing concern, right? And so the market is responding to news that comes out about inflation, which will drive interest rates as a primary driver. And then, you know, we've also got this AI trend going on as kind of a counterpoint to that. It's interesting if you think about what's the best outcome, right? It is that soft landing that we're getting. The Fed seems to have threaded that needle between keeping rates high to keep inflation low, and yet not really having a big negative impact on the economy. So we're getting that growth while keeping rates high to bring inflation down. The one thing that could happen there is inflation comes back, the Fed needs to keep rates high, which finally slows the economy, and you have sort of a stagflation scenario. But that's currently not what the market is expecting, and it seems like a lower probability than we've considered in the past. And you can just see down this page the strong employment. The 10-year is actually at about 4.25 now, up from 3.88, and the Fed funds target rate remains the same. And the big question is, when can they start lowering? Right now, the market is thinking that, you know, maybe at the March meeting, but probably a tick down by the June meeting, which is a lot slower than what we were expecting, what the market was expecting just a quarter ago. I will now take you all the way back to slide 78 in the board book, and I believe it's slide 42 in the hard copy, and it is entitled Private Equity Versus Traditional Assets Performance. So I want to talk a little bit about what's been going on in the private markets, because it's different than what we've seen for quite some time. The private markets through, you may recall, in 2021, your private equity portfolio returned about 60%, where the public markets were not doing nearly as well. And then things started to revert, and the public markets at the end of 2022 just started to zoom ahead, and through 2023, at following the Fed sort of pivot and the belief that the market was not going to be that impacted by higher interest rates. And so...
One more check. What page are we on? Is this
42?
42. Usually a different numbering scheme.
I'm juggling two numbering schemes. Yeah, the S&P 500, which, as I said, through 2023, those seven took up the bulk of the return.
And the others were
6% return for 493 of the 500. So if you look at this slide, you can see just the top part of the slide, the top chart there. You can see going back 3, 5, 10, and 20 years, all those blue bars, which represent different sleeves of private equity, are well ahead of the red bar, which is the Russell 3000, right? The very broad U.S. market index. And then you come to the 1 year number that's ending 12/31/23, and you can see how the Russell 3000 came roaring back, and the private equity was sort of repricing at that point. You know, there is that lagged effect, rising interest rates, narrowing opportunity set, less money being put to work, less realizations, and just underperforming private markets for the first time in a while. So that's one impact where illiquid assets are doing worse than the public markets in the last year. And then you also can see on two slides back, so now in the hard copy, it's slide 44 and slide 80 in the electronic version, and it's the private versus liquid and core real estate. So here's another example where private funds going back 10 years had done much better than REITs, right? Publicly traded real estate investment trusts. You go back 20 years, and it's kind of like what you would expect, right? It's kind of a wash. The public markets have much more volatility, and over time, you know, you would expect them to be similar. But then you see the one-year period, and I'll show an even greater difference in your portfolio. You see the one-year period, negative 2.5 percentage points. So that delta between private market investments and the public REITs inverted for the first time in a long time. So the private markets have been zooming ahead through 2023 and through the first quarter of 2024. Private markets have pulled back, and that they've just kind of caught up, and the valuations have caused an inversion relative to public markets. And then lastly, here, just a couple more things to point out. You guys may recall that I like going to the last page in this deck. It's three more pages back. It's the detailed index returns, and it's the big eye chart that shows all the, or most of the asset classes globally. And I'll stick to the chart on the upper left-hand portion of page 45 in the hard copy. Oh, and 81, yeah. Thank you. And so the domestic equity table on the upper left-hand portion of the page, you can see the S&P 500 going back 10 years, 12 percentage points, which is higher than the long-term average 10-year annualized return of 9 to 10%. So again, the S&P 500 just having a very strong 10-year period. And then you can see, if you just go down a few rows, the Russell 1000 versus the Russell 2000. So that's large cap stocks in the Russell 1000. Again, driven by the Magnificent Seven, mega cap growth stocks versus the Russell 2000. You would expect over time the Russell 2000 is going to outperform the Russell 1000. But on a 10-year average annualized basis, you can see that the large cap has outperformed. And then you look at the nearer term, the one-year period outperformed significantly by, you know, almost 10 percentage points over the last year. And then moving down to the style index, still on that same table, you can see growth versus value. And again, theoretically and over long periods, value has outperformed growth, but not in the last 10 years. You can see the 14.9% over 8.4, and look at the one-year number there. Again, very super reflective of that, those seven stocks and growth in particular, outperforming value by, 31 percentage points in the last year. So you can see how those biases have really skewed performance and gone against what has been typical over the long term. With that, I'll pause before we get to performance and re-log in here to see if there are any questions. Okay. So Just give me a moment. Here we go. Okay, so now I'm going to try and do this again. I'm on the portfolio reconciliation page, and it's on slide 84 electronically and 48 hard copy. Let's see how we did there. And it shows a table up top and then some bar charts down below. And this is just a very high-level summary of what happened over the last 3 months and over your fiscal year. You can see you started the last 3 months with about $10.6 billion, $119 million in net outflows, and then a very solid quarterly investment change of $576, $77 million there, leaving with you with over $11 billion at the end of the at the end of the quarter, which is also the end of the fiscal year. And if you look at the year to date, you started the year with $10.2 billion, negative cash flow of $106 million, and $900 million in net investment change. So a good, solid year getting you to that $11 billion. Moving down a couple of pages, just from a governance perspective, page 86 on the electronic, page 50 on the hard copy, asset allocation versus policy target, you can see that you're in line across the portfolio. Just a quick comment there to let you know that you are near your policy target allocation. And then moving to performance on the next page at a high level. So you can see for the quarter, excuse me, right on top of your policy index, 5.5%, good return on an absolute basis. The 1 year underperforming by 90 basis points and coming mostly in growth and then underperformance on a relative basis in diversifying, but on a very small asset base of only 6.8% of the total portfolio. And then liquidity performing well and getting good solid return in a sleeve where you guys haven't historically gotten those returns, but with cash rates up, the liquidity portion of your portfolio is providing some good juice. And so moving to going into additional detail, let's move to slide 90 in the electronic format and 54 in the hard copy. So this is the total fund performance summary, gross of fees. And then we'll move to through these different sleeves in detail. You can see growth there. I'll sort of focus on the quarter and the year. So growth outperformed for the quarter, outperformed by 30 basis points. Excuse me. Apologize for my voice. And for the year, underperformed by 90 basis points. Now, the interesting point here is this brings up the benchmark discussion we started last month and will continue next month. So you can see this sort of in very clear relief here, that underperformance for the entire growth sleeve doesn't really follow. If you look at the managers below that, you've got all of your managers outperforming their individual benchmarks, right? So the big question is, well, if all the managers are outperforming, how does the composite underperform? And it's really because of that benchmark mismatch that we talked about, right? At the total domestic equity level, you have the Russell 3000, which is the Russell 1000 and the Russell 2000. Thank you so much. We'll see if it helps. So the question is,
is the water going to change the numbers on the page?
It apparently didn't help as much as I would have hoped. So You are benchmarking the total domestic equity relative to the Russell 3000. Your portfolio, your domestic equity portfolio, as we talked about, is overweight value, right? And we showed how value underperforms growth, and it's overweight small cap, and we showed how large cap underperformed small cap based on that Magnificent Seven. So that's what's going on there. And it's the allocation of your domestic equity portfolio relative to that Russell 3000 benchmark. Your managers are doing fine. It's the allocation bias in your portfolio in that sleeve. Moving to the next slide, international. So similar here, outperformance for the quarter, underperformance for the year, and similar story here with the benchmark mismatch in that you have a little bit more in emerging markets, which while your emerging market managers, active management did great, you can see for the year, especially PIMCO, your active management didn't make up for the fact that domestic beat emerging markets, and you have an overweight to emerging relative to domestic. So for the 1 year, again, it's that portfolio implementation that's different than from the benchmark that you're using. A little bit of an bias or an overweight to emerging markets there. Moving to the next slide and talking about private markets. So I touched on private markets not keeping up with public markets for the year. Although I will, in case you're frustrated by that, I will direct you back to your longer term 3, 5, 10 year and showing how that historically, as private markets really outperformed public markets, you were able to take advantage of that. That reversal in the 1 year impacted your performance for your fiscal year. You can see private credit relative to sort of its public markets placeholder. Your private credit didn't do as well as total high yield. If you take your eyes down that page, you can see private real estate down 17.2% versus the Wilshire REIT above it, 16.1. So that was the biggest impact on the private public dispersion there. And then private equity at negative 1%. You can compare that to the S&P at 19, and you can see how your private markets across the complex, credit, real estate, and equity, was a headwind to overall fund performance. Yeah.
What's the reason behind the negative?
So real estate, as we've talked about, is a slow-moving train wreck. So they're so slow with office, slow with multifamily. As coming out of COVID, you're seeing the rent forgiveness through COVID is now leading to folks getting kicked out of their apartments and values declining. So it's sort of a follow up to COVID in the multifamily, and then even retail actually is the bright spot, believe it or not, following, you know, the big train wreck that was retail several years ago. Even light industrial is not the strength that it was over the last 3 or 4 years, as those, you know, the inner city fulfillment centers or the fulfillment centers that are close to cities really were outperforming. So across the four sectors, office is the worst, multifamily, and then light industrial, with retail being the one strong spot. And then in the private markets, you're having this sort of delayed comeuppance, right? The marks to market haven't been as aggressive as the public markets are making the REITs. You know, they trade every day, and people are valued as people really believe the properties are valued. In the private markets, You know, they've got protocols to value those things as close as possible, but when things aren't trading, the marks just aren't made. And so now, at the end of the year, you know, people are worried about what their auditors are going to say, and so they've been taking some more aggressive marks, and that's what you're seeing in this quarter. with respect to how you are invested in those four sectors, whether you're much heavier in office, I don't know the answer to that across all of your private markets funds, but I would expect that you're not significantly overweight office. It's just a matter of the complex is difficult across, with office being the toughest and the delayed marks finally coming to, you know, getting their comeuppance at the end of the year.
And maybe I just add a little bit more color there. We talked with a couple of the managers who had the biggest markdowns in the quarter. What we heard from them is, we've all seen the headlines where office buildings in San Francisco transacted recently at a, you know, 40 to 50% discount relative to their prior transactions that go back, you know, 5 or 10 years. But there's been very little overall transaction. So the fact that you have high-profile distressed transactions kind of being the only marks available in the market, that's filtering through to the marks across all of similar position assets. And it's a very thinly traded market. And so we talked with one manager who had an office building that was 95% leased, you know, had NOI growth, but they took the value down by 40% because the only comparable sale was a distressed sale. And, you know, I think what we're seeing is the distressed sales are happening where the office property has trouble getting leasing up and has a debt maturity in the near term. And we're going to start to see more of that. 2024, there's a buildup of real estate debt that's coming due this year. That's primarily in the regional bank system. So that's going to be a problem for the banks. If the Federal Reserve doesn't cut, doesn't stimulate that market, that bank system is going to have a problem there. But it is largely, the distressed sales are becoming the marks available for the overall marketplace. And so we're just having to watch this. With our portfolio, the bulk of our maturities are in 25 and 26, so we've got a little bit more breathing room there. But it's not a problem that is resolving itself today. It may over the intervening years. So it's a heavy watch it portfolio. And I mean, I think we need to keep in mind that the bulk of the exposure in office was funds that were committed to in 2012 through 2018. There was a logical rationale for it at the time. Unfortunately, you kind of bring those through COVID and the world has shifted. And so, you know, there's a bifurcation in the portfolio. The pre-COVID commitments, it's an asset management issue. It's a debt extension issue. And there's going to be trouble. Post-COVID funds are going to be the new investors in those, hopefully at a reset lower basis. So it's going to be rough, but we're going to capture both sides of it.
So you're saying that the negative 17% reflects a loss on paper, not a hard loss. And so we'll just see how time plays out.
Yeah, we've seen a few properties be returned deed in lieu to the bank, but very few. Most of these are value-add properties where they are leased. There's a question mark about lease renewals, but they are leased and cash flowing positive today, and it is a valuation mark. We're still seeing income from those properties. So.
Yeah, but not to give you a false sense of security, I mean, I think that those paper losses could very well turn out to be real losses, because if you think back to the office example, if you think about what's going on in office, there's millions of square feet out there of unused space because people just haven't returned to the office since COVID came back. And I don't know if I've used this phrase with you guys before, but a real estate professional told me, we're not overdeveloped, we're under-demolished. And so, you know, the notion is that there's some square footage out there that is probably not going to be used again.
We heard from one manager who did the hypothetical. If you had two real estate funds, one that was all in on Class A office space in, you know, coastal markets, and one that was diversified all away from that, one of those funds is going to vastly outperform the other one over the next 5 years. It's really hard to say which one's which right now. But office is walking a tightrope, and it can go either way.
Okay. So moving to the diversifying sleeve on the next slide, you can see the underperformance there is really due to one manager that's Acadian. You can see the performance for Acadian relative to the their benchmark, which is the cash benchmark plus five. And you know, I know Tim and team are looking at this and taking those assets down and redeploying them. So that is a current problem that should be resolved soon. And then in the liquidity portfolio, nothing of interest really to report there, other than the fact that it is finally earning some money and contributing to the overall return of the fund. So just to summarize, there's a bias in the portfolio towards the asset classes that have had headwind related to the Magnificent Seven, growth and large cap. And then also this private markets issue that is a very short-term problem would be expected to revert back to long-term performance. So we expect private markets to outperform public markets over time. Real estate, you know, is kind of the wild card there, and that slow-moving train wreck, we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out. And that concludes my report. Thank you very much.
The water worked in that regard.
Thank you. I'm going to be relatively brief in my remarks because I think Scott covered a lot of the territory that we needed to touch on this period. You got the CIO report in front of you. I'm going to turn to page 3 of that report and the scorecard. Takeaway there, liquidity is working. Risk diversifying remains challenging. We've got a new product that we're taking a look at there. We'll probably talk about that in the next 2 months or so. And growth is really the question there is the complexity paid off? Has the use of private markets paid off? And right now, we're in one of those periods where if public markets rocket ahead, private markets don't have the same beta to that market, so they don't get the same mark up or down. And it's on a lag. So whenever we have a huge up quarter or a huge down quarter in the public markets, we tend to it'll wag this tail here. So right now we're behind the public markets over the trailing 5 year periods. Last quarter that was just slightly behind. Now it's 2.7 behind. That's because we're dealing with, you know, a lot of really, really strong up markets in the public side there. So let me turn you to page 4 on the liquidity program. As Scott mentioned, you know, we're getting a good yield off this. Yields are up in the 5% plus range. Those were in the 0 to 2% range 12 to 18 months ago. So we're getting paid in that space, which is nice. One thing to note is all these managers have roughly a 0 to 4-year duration band. And if you take a look at CIT, it's got a duration of 2.9, and DFA has a duration of 0.5. So these are two managers that have the same latitude to move out in duration or shorten duration, and they're taking very opposite views there. This is interesting. A DFA takes a quantitative approach and says, you know, what's the yield relative to price? And because the short end of the yield curve is still inverted, they're saying we're going to go short and down in quality to get paid. CIT is taking a more fundamental view and saying we think rates are higher for longer, but we do see cuts in the second half of the year. We're going to extend on duration on the expectation of cuts and go up in quality. So you have two managers whose implementations, even though they're in the same space, are really divergent. Both are performing, but it is interesting to note that we have two opposing views in this space here. Take a look at page 5. We'll turn to the growth sub-portfolio. I think the story here has really been that 22 was a difficult year for public markets. 23 was a snapback year, especially in the fourth quarter. We see the product asset growth come up on most all of the managers, a couple of them showing negative there. I think those are more idiosyncratic issues rather than market issues. So Ceradex had a portfolio manager retired, a couple accounts exited at that time. TT has had an ongoing issue both around implementation and around a portfolio manager who's planning to retire at the end of March of this year. And we've done some re-underwriting on that, as has Verus. I think Verus came out with a positive assessment. We went on site with TT. We have a tentatively positive assessment there as well, so we think that's something they can move through. AQR and Panagora showing negatives. This is risk parity, and risk parity has just been a challenge space for some period of time. Take a look at page 6, and we'll get into the performance there. I think the overall story is that domestic and global equity managers have been doing well. If they had exposure to the big mega cap stocks, so much the better. If you're away from that, you're seeing lower returns. But generally speaking, over the trailing 5- and 10-year periods for global equity and domestic equity, these are in the range of where we would expect these returns to be. Where things have come up short is in the international equity and emerging market space. We've talked about emerging markets quite a bit over the past year. PIMCO's had a huge snap back, which has really brought their numbers up. If we went back 3 years ago, we were all concerned about PIMCO's lower returns. They've had that snap back. TT's the one that's doing some struggling now. Within the developed market space, both Pureford and William Blair are competitive versus their benchmarks, but there's just not been a whole lot of growth available in the European marketplace, which tends to be the bulk of that MSCI EAFE index. And that's been a softer place there. I think these are largely going to fall in the realm of asset allocation questions. In the big picture, where do we want to be exposed? The managers are implementing. We have them close to their target benchmarks. The space has been challenged. We have an asset liability study coming back in May of this year. Those will be some key questions we have to ask ourselves in that process. Other areas of note there, high yield. So the line says Voya. That's our high yield manager. This has been a challenge space for a long period of time. High yield tends to trade a little bit more like equity. So huge snapback in the 1 year period there, up 12%. The long-term numbers are still not where we want them to be. This is something we've been reducing over time as we funded private credit. And then AQR and Panagora are two risk parity managers. Again, looking back over 5- and 10-year periods and seeing low single-digit returns, not what we expected from that space. So I think that's something else we'll take a look at during the asset liability study. Then the big story is the private markets, so the last three lines on that page. If you think about the use of leverage in private markets, that kind of tells the tale here. Private equity and real estate both use a lot of leverage. That leverage has gotten more expensive. So if you look at private equity, it's become more expensive on a company that's already operating. It's cash flowing. It's in good shape, generally speaking. So we're seeing a flat year, still a good 5- and 10-year period there. I don't think we should have any expectations that private equity is going to have a tailwind on the leverage side. Leverage is more expensive. We're finding that our managers use less leverage today than they did 3 years ago. But I think the opportunity set there is still solid for the right type of manager. And when I say right type, we are looking specifically for managers with operational expertise so they can drive value regardless of leverage. That's not necessarily the case in the industry writ large, so we're very specifically trying to target that profile of manager. And then we go to the bottom line, real estate. Again, the leverage has gotten more expensive, and you have fundamental issues. So then you're seeing the larger markdowns there. That's going to be, it's going to take time to process those legacy pieces, but I think the next 2 years will be going to give us a lot of insight into where our past losses might look like, or opportunities, or gains below expectations versus what the future is that cue us up for a better future. It's very murky right now. In the middle line, private credit. So this is the lenders into the private equity and now increasingly into the real estate space as well. So these are floating rate loans. So with the SOFR rising up, we're making a lot more money off this. We would normally expect to see more stress coming out of that marketplace because the borrowers are paying a much higher cost. Candidly, we have not. We expected to see stress last year. We're not seeing the stress yet. We continue to watch this on a quarterly basis, expecting to see defaults, covenant breaches start to pick up there. It has not come through yet. So it may not, which would be the Goldilocks scenario. Right now, that's something we're watching carefully, and it's just not showing up, so we're still clipping a really solid coupon there. One other thing I would need to mention on private credit. So we have some real estate debt inside of private credit. One of those managers is Torchlight. We just got an announcement late last week that Dan Heflin, who is the leader of the organization, is going to be moving to a co-CIO role and chairman role. So reflecting the fact that Greg Deenan, who is the chief credit officer, is kind of coming up in the organization. I did speak with Dan. Dan views this as, this is a reflection of where the team is operating today, that Greg is operating at that level. Dan has no intentions of retiring. He views this as, yes, it is succession planning, but he wants to more carefully reflect the contributions of the team. So if any of you have met Dan Heflin, he is incredibly engaged, and I'm not hearing any indication that he's less engaged. Just that the rest of the team is operating at a higher level. That said, we're going to keep watching that carefully. Then if we move to page 9, so diversifying program, we've talked about this in the past, that we've had a strong fixed income bias to this program over the past. We've made some implementations decisions that have moved away from that. We have another research process underway, which we expect to wrap up in the next 3 to 6 weeks, and something that's not related to, that's trend following, not fixed income related. But we have an issue with Acadian as well. So we have begun adjusting the size of the Acadian portfolio. We think they're in a holding period kind of piece right now. They had the founder of the team was let go last fall. They have an interim head. We've met with them multiple times since that's happened. Performance has begun to improve this year, but there's still a lack of conviction on that one. And so we've been reducing that wave. And then if we move to page 10, we try to capture more of the upside, less of the downside. Good news is the blue is still above the red line. The troubling news is that gap is about as close as it's ever been. This does reflect a trailing 3-year period. So we're talking about 2021, 2022, and 2023. 21 and 23, very, very strong years for the public markets, which we don't expect to capture all of that. 22, a down year where we had a buffer there. So I think there is some logic to this, but we want to see that. I think if we continue to have candidly, if the Magnificent Seven continue to run for another year, we're not going to be capturing all of that exposure because we have a diversified program. And the market is very narrowly concentrated there. We saw some hopeful signs in the fourth quarter that was broadening out. This year, it's kind of gone back to the narrow market and everything else. So in the short term, the market's not supporting our asset allocation. In the long term, we think it makes sense, but we are going to do it through an asset liability review later this year. So you wrap it all up on page 11. I'm just going to take a look at that second table there. On a sharp ratio basis over 3, 5, and 10-year periods, we're either matching the simple implementation or exceeding it. We are lagging the simple target index implementation because of that public markets run. Over 10 years, we are beating it, but over the shorter periods, there is a lag built in there. With that, I'd take any questions from trustees.
To private credit, you were describing watching the private credit side very carefully. What kind of a plan do you have if, in fact, it begins to go in the wrong direction?
Right now, it's a question of how it would go in a wrong direction. So we think we could have default rates come up considerably from where they are, and we'd still have a positive return simply because of the high base rate. So the managers we have in place within the separately managed accounts all have workout capabilities. That was one of our requirements. We didn't want anybody who didn't have the ability to do workouts. And that's a kind of a rare breed in today's environment because nobody has done a debt workout since the great financial crisis. But all the managers we have in place have those teams. And so the question is, Will the workout processes be as smooth as we would like to see, or are we going to see hiccups there? So if we start to see default rates pick up above 1% to 2%, then we're going to be doing deeper dives into, with StepStone, into are the workout teams operating as expected, and what are our recovery rates? So just because there's a default, if you have a high recovery rate, you can still have a positive outcome there. So this is less of a concern for me that we could have a big downturn. My bigger concern is, couldn't the numbers erode down into the higher single digits at this point? Right now, we're at 9%. We're clipping coupons closer to 11% right now, which is great. We just view it as unsustainably high. And so when those issues come, the question is the workout and the recovery rates.
Do you have, obviously, some managers may do it successfully, some may not on the workouts. Do you have, on a manager-by-manager basis, some level at which you would attempt to sell off at the then current value those loans?
So the way we have this set up is StepStone runs this as a fund-to-one for us. So StepStone has the fiduciary responsibility. Within that, you know, we're heavily involved in dialogue with them. If we started to see, if we lost confidence in one of the separately managed accounts, we could simply shut off the recycling ability, and then as money comes in, we just start bringing that back, and it slowly goes in. It goes into liquidation mode over about 3 years. So the sale is trickier there, but there's a self-liquidating mechanism if we lose confidence.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Any other questions for Tim? International-wise, is it...
Mainly a European issue, or is it across the board?
Well, it's a European issue because that's the bulk of the index exposure for MSCI EFA.
Okay.
I think the fact that Europe lacks as robust of a technology sector as the United States has tells us a lot about that. Scott had mentioned, you know, value not working. Well, value works in Europe because there's not a Magnificent Seven in Europe. So Europe has a heavier weighting to financials, industrials, materials than does the United States. So it is, you know, quote unquote, operating normally, I guess, are operating more in line with our past expectations of markets. But the overall growth rate in Europe is much more subdued than what you see in North America or in Southeast Asia. And so there are pockets of growth there, but the public market writ large is a lower growth type of exposure, just on sector basis alone.
Any other questions?